The AI market, I think, is becoming even bigger than our wildest imaginations. I mean, like, this is the type of stuff where you start to realize, oh, this is serious. This is not a joke.
How are we not at the beginning of the greatest bull market of all time?
Dude, we're gonna have to tax the shit out of these robot companies.
Elon has talked about this specifically. If civilization dies, Tesla dies. Like, we have to do the things that keep civilization alive. We have to do the things that make civilization thrive.
And I'm really curious to get your opinion on this, Amit, because you follow the broader market. You are very knowledgeable about a lot of unique companies, tech companies, innovative companies. But to me, it feels like the common thread that retail investors seem to have figured out how to properly value is that it's culture, it's CEO, it's the staff. Whereas the broader, like the rest of the market, Wall Street, is much more focused. They overweight earnings, they overweight cash flow, they overweight like recent earnings performance, right?
Lagging indicators.
They overweight. They put too much of a sort of value in like the traditional metrics, but there is no way for them they choose to ignore like who the CEO is. Why is he special? Who has he surrounded himself with? What kind of culture have they implemented, right? Or she? Like, what does the staff say about the CEO? How flat is the org? What are they working on? Like, what's the actual technology? Do I understand the technology? I'm not in these like VC circles, and I'm not in these like hedge fund circles. So I'm sure that's part of the conversation. But I think that's what's so interesting about this entire discussion is like, if the broader market valued CEO culture, et cetera, as much as retail does, or like this group right here does, I guess, then I feel like Hood would be at $500 billion instead of $50 billion. I feel like Tesla would have been at $3-4 trillion instead of like $700 trillion, whatever it is, because then you are properly bringing that forward, that valuation. It's just like there is this, I think this, perhaps from their side, it's like, well, you have to show me. It has to show up on the P&L. Like, would you agree with that sort of analysis? Go ahead, Hans, and then...
Yeah, I want to hear Amit's answer, and then I will. I have a very interesting perspective to share on that whole, like, you know, what you're talking about is a war between two different sets of ideas. And I was listening before we got on to a little bit of Palmer Luckey on the Moonshots podcast with Peter Diamandis, and he had a point in there that applies to this. And I want to come back.
To that. Are you talking about the IPO point about Tesla investors that he made?
The Tesla investors, and also just how, like, if he IPOs, the yes, type of strategy exactly. that he wants to employ. So
that was a great part of the podcast. Look, should I think Robinhood's $500 billion right now? I think they have the potential to, but also, you know, the street's just not going to give them that valuation until they put up that growth. But I agree, the reason they're even getting the multiple that they're getting right here is because the street believes that it's very possible. The difference here between Palantir and Tesla, though, like, Tesla's getting the, you know, what is 140 times PE or whatever before they show any of the growth after one of the, you know, crappiest quarters they've had in a while, because Tesla's revenue is qualitative enough to feel that it's not cyclical. So, for example, if the market tanks, Robinhood doesn't make any money because people are going to stop trading, right? People are going to be afraid to put money there. You know, everyone's just going to be on the sidelines, and they're going to benefit from some of the volatility, but it's not going to be that expansive. Whereas Tesla, if they unleash a robotaxi, even if there are certain days of the year where the robotaxi is not being used as much, like, it is an official product that's out. It's like, it's almost like SaaS revenue compared to Robinhood's revenue. SaaS revenue is sticky. It's repeatable. It's not going away. Whereas Robinhood's revenue is very cyclical, and they're trying to diversify that, but they haven't really diversified it yet. Right now, we've been in a bull market for 3 years. That's why Robinhood's done well. If we get into a bear market for the next 3 years, Robinhood stock is going to be in the gutter because people are just not going to be trading. Their transaction revenues are going to go down. So do I think they're a $500 billion company? Yes. I think they're probably even more than that in the future, but they've got to show that growth, and it'll probably take a decade. But I think the market can give Tesla that valuation way quicker because the potential of an optimist is so solid that it matters more than the cyclical nature of transaction volumes.
Go ahead, Hans. Did you want to...
So the point that Palmer was making was, and this is a dynamic that I've seen play out with lots of these types of founders that were, you know, we've identified as these, you know, premium top tier founders like Jensen Huang, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel and Alex Karp with Palantir. I think Vlad probably would fall into this. And then also, yeah, this is the way that Paul Merluckey thinks about his company, even though he's not a public market CEO yet, where, you know, it's about attracting the people who believe in the mission. So you've got to state your mission. It's got to be a compelling mission. It's got to be something that is worth believing in. And so you do that to bring in the people across every, you know, like bring in the stakeholders across every part of the business. So that's not just your management team. That's not just your employee base, but it's also your investor base, both private market and public market. And when you do that, and then you also say, okay, not only do I want to attract the right people, I want to repel the wrong people. And like anyone who's good at hiring, you understand this, that you want to word your, you know, job application stuff in such a way that the type of people that you're sick and tired of dealing with at your company just automatically think, nah, that sounds like too much of a pain in the butt. And you want that, you know, both for your employees, but also for your investors. And this is something that Elon has done. This is one of the reasons why, you know, we can have 140 PE on the company before we have really started to capitalize on, you know, that robotaxi revenue yet. And, you know, that's probably soon to grow again if we do start to see that execution, because he's told the story so long and so well, and we can see with our own eyes all of those leading indicators being put in place, that you've got the fleet, you've got the data, you've got the AI expertise, you've got the FSD system that is level two, that's like far and away the best level two system in the world. You've got this compute cluster that just keeps growing and growing and growing. And so, you know, like anyone who understands the bitter lesson in AI that says that the two things to always bet on are data and compute, and that, you know, fancy schmancy, too smart for their britches AI expert systems always lose to data and compute. Like, you can see Tesla's building a giant data and compute machine that even makes, you know, like you would think that Waymo would understand this being part of the Google empire. Like, the bitter lesson has never been demonstrated by anyone in AI better than Google DeepMind, but they just are not doing what's necessary to make those types of bets on the Waymo autonomous driving system for whatever reason. And that, you know, like all the people who hate it and they short it. They think this is ridiculous. They think it's stupid. But those people stay out. And then the people are like, yeah, no, I get it. I get the story. I get the advantages. I agree not only with your strategy, but I've seen the history of execution, and I see the right things in the right places to continue to execute forward into the future. And so, like, I am willing to pay ahead for those future earnings, because I think, like, I'm going to apply a much lower discount rate to your execution likelihood in the future. And so I think that to your point, Farzad, you're like, the street doesn't get it. They don't want to. It's like the types of CEOs like Elon Musk, they want to make sure that those people who don't believe in the mission don't get it on purpose and bet against the company, so that they're not part of the investor base who's making decisions about how the company gets run, about who's on the board, about all of the, you know, shareholder vote issues. Like, those people need to stay the fuck out. And we want the people who understand and believe on the inside.
Thank you for the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellionaire. Now, I know a lot of you that watch this podcast, this channel, are huge Tesla investors, Tesla fans. Now, Rebellionaire is the perfect investment firm for somebody like you.
A lot of people who are large shareholders of Tesla are great at managing their own investments, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you actually have all of the tools at your disposal to help with some of the other things, like financial planning, trying to figure out what the timing of trimming and adding your core positions, maybe even doing some covered calls to maximize the cash flow from your portfolio. And these are all services that Rebellionaire is specifically built to be able to help you with. And they're not like other financial firms that are just generic firms that have generic cookie cutter advice, and a lot of times really look down on investors like yourself who have large concentrated positions that they view as being too risky, or that they really don't want to either facilitate for you or to even be involved in advising someone who is so willing to take risks that they view are unacceptable.
And the reason why you won't get the cold shoulder is because Rebellionaire understands you, because Bradford and Matt, both who work at Rebellionaire, and you, I'm sure you know who they are if you follow this channel, they're both also retail investors in Tesla. So they understand the kind of research that goes into the story, things like tracking FSD, Optimus Robot, energy, and all the other things related to Musk industry. So if that's something that's interesting to you, go ahead and check them out. Go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, rebellionaire.com/Farzad. We'll have a link for that in the description in the comment section below. And that's how they know that we sent you. Now back to the podcast. You know what's interesting about that too is I remember listening to that pod. It was such a good pod. I highly recommend everybody goes and checks it out with Pierre Diamandis and Palmer Luckey on the Moonshots. Right, that was the name of the podcast series. I think it's like 2 or 3 hours long. I forget how long it is, but I remember him specifically saying, "I have to go out and say some crazy shit so that to make sure." And I'm like, as soon as he said that, it's funny you bring that up, right? I'm like, wow, Elon's been doing that for like his whole life. So I wonder, like, how much of that is premeditated, right? But I think the other side of that too is like, it's a combination of that, like supreme candor and like a calculated sort of like anti-PC, anti-culture sort of like, this is what I'm looking for. But then the vision itself has to resonate deeply with those investors. It has to be a legitimately existential type mission statement that you're trying to solve towards, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah. This is what captivates investors. This is why Karp gets the premium that he gets on Palantir, why Tesla gets the premium. Hood is getting a premium, even though they are putting up, you know, 50% revenue growth. They're buying back $1.5 billion. There's not a lot of companies that can put up 50% growth and buy back their stock. Usually it's one or the other. So the fact that they're doing that is incredible. But I agree. I mean, like, if you believe in Vlad's long-term vision of where financial ecosystems are going to go, if you believe in Karp's vision around the future of the West, you believe in Elon's vision around AI, it's easy to pull forward that demand. And, you know, hedge funds say, oh, that's just dumb retail buying into a narrative. I'm like, but those stocks have done incredible over the past 5 years. They've beaten the S&P. They've beaten probably any sophisticated strategy that Vanguard has come up with for their clients. And it's because when you have a cult of investors that actually believe in the future, this is a market where the future is the only thing that matters right now.
All right. Can we switch gears to Palantir real quick? Did you have any more questions, Hans, on Hoodie?
No, that's a good opening segment for, because I do want to talk about Palantir. It's been on a tear.
Yes, it's been on a tear. So, okay, again, as somebody from the outside looking in, when Amit came, fair enough. When Amit came on the podcast, what was it, like a year ago or however long it's been, when you finally got me up to speed as far as what Palantir's true potential was in the long term. And it finally clicked for me that this is like a civilization OS. Yeah. Sort of like, that's how I view Palantir. It's like long-term potential civilization OS. And then, but here's what's funny. So when I look at today's, because I'm trying to figure out when to go in. Like, I'm actually legitimate. Like, I want to think about, when do I start building a Palantir position, right? It's like, don't time the market. And it's part of my, like, just start buying. But then I'm like, okay. And I'm a Tesla investor. Okay. I'm an all-in Tesla investor. Okay. I mean, every dollar that I have in stocks is in Tesla stock. Okay. And so I should know about valuations. I'm very deeply not. Okay. Then I look at, so I'm like, okay, Palantir, $300 billion company. Okay, cool. $1 billion in revenue.
No. $4 billion, $1 billion in free cash flow.
Fair enough. $4 billion in revenue, $1 billion in free cash flow. Okay, which is, I mean, that really speaks to sort of their ability to sort of be profitable, and they have no debt. They have a healthy balance sheet, right? Like, these guys are lean as hell. They generate cash flow, they generate profit. But then the revenue line, I'm like, okay, so help me understand Palantir's true long-term TAM. Like, what are we talking about here? Right? Like, what, give me a number. Like, help me understand how big is this, like, replacing, is this basically being adjacent to every cloud and sort of like SaaS type thing? Like, are we talking about a $2 trillion TAM? Are we talking about, like, in every single device that would ever exist on the planet, Palantir is like somehow on the, like, the foundation layer powering, like, help me understand that so I can start buying the fucking stock.
Okay, so I think to start off this, let's just first address the valuation. The stock is expensive, obviously. $300 billion market cap, it's it's a bigger market cap than Salesforce, and Salesforce does a decent chunk of free cash flow. I don't know how to explain the valuation from a quantitative perspective, and I haven't been able to explain it since around $50. By the time I got to 50, I was like, this is really, like, it's getting up. It was at 16 in January last year. Now it's at 50. It ended the year at 80. Now it's at 130. It hit 133 last week. I'm like, I have resorted to finding qualitative ways to explain the valuation, because I kind of sound stupid if I try using just the pure numbers, because the numbers don't really get you there. So then it begs the question, right? If you can't get there through the numbers, but you still want to buy the stock. And I bought some stock before earnings at 124. So I bought it. I bought it at 6. I bought it at 20. I bought it at 30. I'm buying at 124. I want to just get more shares as well. Why do I still want more shares at this valuation? Because ultimately, if you're buying a stock, you expect the valuation to increase in the future. I think what's going on with Palantir is that it's getting a premium and getting a multiple based on the idea. And I really think this is the genuine reason, if we want to even blend the quantitative and the qualitative. The AI market, I think, is becoming even bigger than our wildest imaginations. Jensen said a bunch of stuff last night. We can get through all the, you know, ChatGPT getting to almost a billion users. If this market really is going to be bigger than our most wildest imaginations, and I'm sharing a chart right here that you can bring up that kind of solidifies this via some evidence. This is Netscape when it came out in 1994. Its first 617 days. It's in blue, ChatGPT is in red. ChatGPT came out 2 years ago, about December 2022. If we stretch it out to those full 3 years of the first release of Netscape, as you can see, the blue, you had the markets as the NASDAQ composite go pretty nuclear, right? There's a line that keeps going up and to the right. We are still in that red spot when it comes to ChatGPT 2 years later after its December launch. Which means we still have a massive, when Dan Ives says it's 10 p.m. at the party, I mean, I think this is the chart that exemplifies that it's 10 p.m. at the party. If ChatGPT is just getting started and Netscape was a browser, ChatGPT, one could argue, is way more important than a browser, the implications of it are going to be so unbelievably gigantic that NVIDIA is going to have a lot more demand, Tesla is going to have a lot more demand, robots are coming, FSD, enterprise workflow management systems that fundamentally increase the paradigm for productivity, which is kind of a selling point of enterprise software. It's like, can you get margins to go up? That stuff's going to be bigger than we could possibly imagine. That is the only way I can come to a conclusion outside of pure hype and momentum for why Palantir is getting this multiple. And I don't think it's just hype and momentum, because all that hype and momentum, I would say, went from 20 to like 70 in 2024. That's when, if you want to say retail was pumping, okay, retail, but retail doesn't have the money to buy it at 300 billion, or doesn't have the money to keep pumping it up to 300 billion. Like, this is not GameStop where it's shorted 500% and retail wants to stick it to the hedge funds. Palantir's short float is less than 3%. No one wants to short this thing. There is no squeeze. So the only conclusion I can come to is that the street, big money, is buying Palantir. Palantir fell from 125 to 65 only because the market fell from 6,000 to 4,800 on the S&P. The market has not recovered yet, but Palantir has made new highs. That to me is not hyper momentum. I mean, I'm sure there's some momentum there, but that's really big money saying, hey, this was our opportunity to get in. We're not going to let this go. We believe this is going to be the pure play AI software platform for the world. Now, in terms of TAM, Karp said 2 years ago, their TAM is about 900 billion. I think that TAM has probably doubled given the momentum of AI and the necessity for AI workloads via hyperscalers, which ultimately requires some type of B2B software to make sense of all that. That is Palantir. Number two, I think when you look at some of the results, so AIG, biggest insurance company in the world, they said on their earnings call two months ago, Palantir has doubled our revenue CAGR, or our projected revenue CAGR, from 10% to 20% for the next 5 years.
Holy shit.
And that's a real quote. That's a real quote. They invited Karp to their investor day. They said our revenue CAGR, which is what we need to get a multiple on our stock, is
just for the audience. CAGR is compounded annual growth rate. It's just basically like, it's you're compounding your growth. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And so if you double your CAGR, just to put a fine point on that, that doesn't mean that 10 years from now, you're going to make twice as much money as you make today. It's more like 100 times more money in 10 years.
Because you're compounding, because each year is getting bigger, and each year is bigger on the bigger number. Go ahead.
And the question is why? Well, Palantir has built an agentic solution. We hear a lot about agents, an agentic solution to automate workflows in the process of underwriting, which is what AIG is in the business of, underwriting insurance, to be able to make a spread on the money that they bring in. And so the company has 769 customers. This is less than 1,000 customers, government and commercial. Revenue growths are at 40%. They reaccelerated revenue. That's fine. I think they got to get to 50, 60% to really begin to make sense of the multiple that they're getting. But the point is, this company should have 8,000 customers one day. Salesforce already has 8,000 customers. Snowflake already has 5,000. Palantir is making the same amount of revenue as a Salesforce maybe just a little bit under that, but like basically the same, 3.5 to 3 billion with a tenth of the customer base. And so when you just think about the pure opportunity at scale and then TAM, I think that is why the street gives Palantir the multiple that they're giving, because the quantitative numbers don't make sense for it, but the qualitative numbers start to point to a very different story. OpenAI is worth $300 billion in the private markets. They're not even profitable. Palantir is actually delivering results to an AIG, to an Airbus, to a BP, to a DOD, to the UK Ministry of Defense, and they're profitable. So I think when you put all that together, and then you give Karp a little bit of a premium, because this guy can actually inspire people to care about his company, that's where you get Palantir's multiple at where it's trading.
Let me make a couple of additional points to Amit. And I'll say this first, giving the disclaimer that I'm currently trimming my Palantir position to try and create funds to go into Tesla options, because I love Palantir. But, you know, just right now at the timing of the cycles, I feel like I just can't not have Tesla leaps moving into, you know, the next 2 years as we're rolling out robotaxis and Optimus robots. But that said, this is what my personal assessment of kind of what's going on. It doesn't really answer your TAM question, but just as far as an analysis, I think that one of the things that Amit said was, it seems like smart money is really, or, you know, Wall Street money, big hedge fund money, is valuing the stock very highly, which is kind of different than some of the other companies that we've been talking about. I think part of the reason for that is that these people are hearing from in their circles, hey man, you got to try Palantir, or hey man, Palantir absolutely on fire, like kicking ass and taking names for my business.
So it's like similar to like how when the Model S first came out for Tesla, like, and you know, like that's how like fanatics like us, sort of like you and I, Hans, and other people were like, holy shit, this is so much better than a gas car. This is unbelievable. So it's that sort of same thing. It's like people use the product, they're mind blown by it, and the word of mouth spreads. It's like, bro, you gotta get a Palantir. It just makes your life so much better, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And, you know, it's like for big companies, you know, not little companies like AIG, Airbus, the United States government. Like if they can, you know, the question is like, oh, they're just a defense contractor, man. Like, what do they know how to, you know, sell software to the enterprise? And it's like, yeah, if it can help SEALs kill terrorists better, and it can help Airbus save millions of dollars in maintenance and supercharge AIG's compound annual growth rate, yeah, they can do all those things. And apparently doing each one of those things make them better at the other. And so like the network effect is incredible. So I think that that's, you know, that's a big part of it. The other big part of it is that they're building operating leverage, that they just have this incredibly tight team that continues to be able to grow more and bigger and better faster. And so like their growth rate is outpacing, you know, their growth rate in headcount. And that operating leverage looks powerful. And it really comes down to the fact that, you know, they've been building this infrastructure. Like, man, it just sucks to make software work and be seamless for complicated use cases. It's so freaking hard. And that's why Palantir has always been this company that, you know, looked like a consultancy from the outside, because they had these forward deployed engineers who literally go work at the customer's business and just make the software freaking work. And that's something that other companies, they didn't want to, you know, spend all of that money up front to make their software work. And they've done this across so many businesses, so many use cases. And the whole time they're doing their job, they're also then taking their learnings on the job, how to make this work in someone else's business, into how do I make the platform work better? So the next time I have to make it work for this use case, it's like 10 times easier and 10 times faster. And right now they're plugging in AI to their own business to figure out, how do we actually expand our ability to onboard customers and get their time to value down? Even like, it's already the best time to value solution on the market by far. And they're continuing to drive that down just, you know, relentlessly. And they will continue to do that. And, you know, the dream is that eventually they won't have to have forward deployed engineers at all. This is something that, you know, companies can just adopt and plug into their business. And, you know, the fully AI powered
agent runs around and hooks everything up.
Yeah. It just like let it loose inside your business and it fixes it all for you. But like, that's not a solution that you can get to overnight. Like there's so many iteration cycles and so much engineering brain power that has to be applied in order to solve that problem. And they are on the flywheel that makes that path something that is realistic and possible. And no one else is doing that.
So Palantir's true long-term value proposition is that they are by far the best company at taking a business's data or information and creating actions that actually make the business better and more profitable.
In the most labor hour efficient way possible on a trend to where those human labor hours go as close to zero as possible.
Got it.
Okay. Like we don't have any fully, you know, just AI solutions that work. That thing just doesn't exist anywhere. Everything is a combination between human engineering and AI assistance. And Palantir is some of the highest leverage, like lowest human labor to highest AI assistance leverage play out there.
Got it. And one of the bottlenecks, and I'll throw it to you here, Amit. So, and one of the bottlenecks, from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the secret sauce behind this is that ontology layer. Yeah. Like that's the thing that gets everything to fucking work. But that takes the forward engineers. That takes time. It's complex. It's unique to each business, right? But that's where like your AI agents or like that AI process can come in and actually do that work or do most or all of that work at some point in the future. Whereas you just drop Palantir into, and this is a very simplified, stupid way of explaining it. You drop Palantir into your business, you turn on the agent sets up everything. And then you have this thing that says, here are the most important things you got to pay attention to. Here are the actions that you have to take based on these very important things. And here's how you track the progress against these very important things. Go. Right? Is that a fair way of describing the value prop? Okay.
The ontology is the digital representation of the business, almost like a digital twin in the context of the verbs, the nouns, the adjectives of the business, and then ultimately what actions to take. A lot of people think of it as like business analytics and business intelligence, which it is, but I would think of that on a different level in terms of the actual route that needs to be taken in order for things to make sense. I mean, a perfect example is Wendy's. I was interviewing the Wendy's guy at AIPCon, which is Palantir's conference, and they did a promotion with like SpongeBob that like led to a lot of demand, and AIP, via the ontology, because it's connected to all the tribal knowledge of the actual business itself, was able to say, hey, in 2 days, you're going to run out of patties. And like, if you don't do any of that, you're not going to get the benefits of this partnership with SpongeBob. You have to do something right now. So it was able to do sort of this predictive simulation of what would happen. And you need something that's intelligent to do that. Now imagine that with BP, with oil, which is, one could argue, a lot more important than hamburgers, right? Like there's so many
I don't know, bro. Burgers are pretty important.
Burgers are pretty important, but you know, we need the gas in our cars to be able to get to those burgers, or at least the gas to power the electricity grid to charge our Teslas. Or with the DOD, right? When someone's on the battlefield and you need to do a predictive simulation to not step into a landmine. I mean, like this is the type of stuff where you start to realize, oh, this is serious. This is not a joke. And the market is compounding at such a big growth rate in terms of the AI demand that's there. They just got a big deal with NATO. So their Palantir sucks in Europe. No one wants to buy their stuff in Europe. That's probably because they don't really love the company, get the company. They think of them as an evil company with Peter Thiel. Why did NATO just sign up with Project Maven? And if they did get NATO, I think Germany, France, a lot of these countries are going to start to get on board. And that growth is being pulled forward, which means the stock could be flat for a while because the growth has been pulled forward. But if they accelerate against even those expectations, maybe the stock continues to go higher.
So how much of the bottleneck in user growth is the ontology layer and the forward engineers? Like how much of a wall is that to say, because it is software ultimately, Palantir self software. So in my head, I'm like, if I'm thinking from first principles, like if the easier it is to get Palantir ramped up, the more customers you'll have, right? And the more it can operate on its own. It's just like that. It's as simple as download, upload, like download, install, or whatever it is, right? So how much of that is the biggest bottleneck for them to grow faster? And how much of that is can be loosened up and done easier with the advent of more powerful AI, more powerful agents, more automatable processes. So help me understand those two things.
Yeah, the bottleneck you correctly identified is the four deployed engineers and the ontology, because Palantir doesn't really work unless you set up an ontology in your business. And that takes a lot of time and energy and resources, but you also need the four deployed engineers to help you set up that ontology, which is why they only have 800 customers, but they're still producing $4 billion in revenue. So it's like the quality of the software is something people pay a pretty penny for, but the logistics of setting it up is hard. Now, to your point, that shouldn't be a bottleneck, right? Because it's software. It should be able to just like expand. And that's where they have this new concept they're working on called AI FDEs, AI forward deployed engineers. And the whole concept there is if they can automate, essentially create agents, Farzad, where to set up the ontology, someone doesn't have to go fly down to your office, but they can have an AI agent kind of set it up for you, which is really advanced. But if they can do that, it should be able to exponentially scale, which would reduce a lot of the bottlenecks.
And, you know, one of the things just to say about the ontology is that if you don't, like, if you do something else for business analytics and you don't have an ontology, it's like, you know, 99% likelihood that there are opportunities in your business that you have zero visibility into because you don't have an ontology. You don't have a way to connect all of the implications of all the pieces of data that you have together in a way that allows you to make those smart business decisions. So like, yes, it is kind of expensive to do it, but like, it's almost guaranteed to be a positive ROI once you do it, because it will reveal to you the things that you have no ability to see today. And then I would add, beyond just doing the AI FDEs right now, they've also opened up AIP as a developer platform that anyone can use. And I know they're like, these are not people that they're really counting in a major way in their customer base, but there are a lot of startups now that are just building from the ground up with AIP and the like. Any halfway decent software engineer can build on AIP. Like you don't, you know, there's nothing that they have to learn that is more difficult than any other, you know, software tool that they have to learn inside of AIP. And so this is going, I think that's going to be one of the other big drivers of growth, is that these people who are AI native companies that are looking to grow and scale with, you know, an AI first approach, they can set up with something like AIP. And you know, there's lots of other options that they have. And, you know, lots of people are, you know, just using Claude and, you know, Cursor and, you know, setting up their own systems. But I think there's a lot of benefits to doing that purely with AIP. And then the question is just, you know, what's the split going to be between Palantir and the company long-term on revenue? And there's not a whole lot of clarity around. So actually, I think that's a big thing, that there's an opportunity for Palantir to do a better job, or maybe they have done, and I'm just not aware of it, but maybe do a little bit better job of explaining what the monetization on those like AIP first companies is going to be long-term, so that people can, you know, build with a little bit more certainty. But like that's, there are a number of people that I'm tracking who are using AIP to build their software startups on. And I'm really excited about that potential as well. Because if you do that, then like the ontology grows as you grow your business.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so easy to set it up to get started. Like, you know, it's not this thing where you've got this sprawling 1,000 person org with, you know, complicated manufacturers, suppliers, customers, and supply chains and all these things. Like you just start from zero and then your ontology grows with your business. And like, it's not this thing that you ever have to think about investing into. It's just there from the, you know, day that you get started.
It's network effects and they scale pretty aggressively. And, you know, for people that say it's not that special, it hasn't been replicated. Same thing with Hood, right? Their design hasn't been replicated. Palantir has 20 years of patents developing the ontology layer. And, you know, originally Palantir was created after 9/11. The whole idea was, how do we give the government tools that protect civil liberties so that the government can't violate our sovereign identities, but also protects to help them know, hey, Al-Qaeda might be planning an attack. How do you create that? That's a very complex, it's a genius concept to be able to come up with that. Peter Thiel, again, one of the best investors in the world. But then how do you implement that? And then how do you go from government software to then bring that to the commercial landscape. Like, that's a really complicated thing to do. And I think they figured it out over the past 20 years. And is the market rewarding them with a aggressive multiple? Yeah, but maybe it's because they deserve it, because they spent 20 years trying to figure out how to even solve the problem in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. These are the kind of conversations that get me so excited about, like, the future of just this, like, just AI tech, like high tech, super advanced stuff, these leaders that are working on this stuff. And okay, so let me ask you this question. So, okay, before I shift to more macro, Hans, did you want to add anything else to Palantir? No? How much longer do we have you for? Okay, we're almost at an hour already. Oh, this fucking thing's flying.
20 more minutes. That's good.
Okay.
I guess one thing I could say real briefly on Palantir is that, you know, tying back into the conversation that we were having earlier about, you know, bold CEOs that, you know, have a strong vision, and what Peter Thiel and Alex Karp have been building is this, it is a very polarizing product that we want. And a lot of the things that need, like, as far as if you look at how society needs to develop over the long term to be a place that facilitates human thriving, a lot of those problems are really, really hard, and they involve difficult trade-offs. And a lot of people want to be ideologues, and they want to be like, okay, no, like, we don't want any, like, defund the police. The police are bad. We want to defund them. We don't want any police. Well, actually, that's a terrible solution. Like, you can't do that. But you also can't be like, yeah, the police can do whatever they want. Like, you have to wade into this very difficult, very messy, real life problem and figure out how you make trade-offs between these competing ideals. And I mean, that's what Palantir, like, started as. And I think the willingness and, like, the stomach and the courage necessary to wade into those types of problems, when you do that and you come out the side with a solution that works, like, the quality of that solution is just, like, order of magnitude better than other stuff that gets built by people who don't have that stomach for adversity.
And so, and we're seeing a lot of that. And it's, this is kind of ties back to my sort of, like, the question I was going to ask, like, talk with macro, is, like, we're seeing a lot of, it seems like, again, maybe this is like, I could be reading this wrong, or maybe I wasn't exposed to this nearly as much before, but it feels like, it seems like, it looks like there is this re-engagement into high risk, high reward. Let's work on difficult stuff. Let's not demonize, let's actually focus on building really cool shit, very important shit,
and
let's
That
actually works. Okay. And so this underpins my question. Okay. So on your market open stream this morning, by the way, go check out Amit on YouTube, best Binance live stream on the planet. If you disagree with me, you're wrong. I'm sorry. The guy gets like 18 trillion live viewers at every live stream. Okay. He's the GOAT. Go check him out, Amit. So if that's true, okay, and then we also have the multiplier of AI, how are we not at the beginning of the greatest bull market of all time?
You know
let me tie back to the point I was trying to make too. Like, this you were talking about Moody's, the downgrade on Friday, right? The market don't give a shit. We're green.
Nope.
Okay. How is this not the beginning of the greatest bull market of all time? Do not invest on what I'm saying at all. This is not financial market advice. I'm just talking about my feelings. This is not even, this is just deep in my nether region, let's say. Okay. I just feel it. There's something going on. Okay. Am I stupid? Help me understand what I'm feeling.
No, you're right. And it's why I've continued to invest in NVIDIA, because the controversial investment on NVIDIA right now is that they are cyclical. They are like Cisco. They're building out the pipelines, but eventually they'll be done. The more evidence that I'm seeing from just lots and lots of sources, anecdotal and data-driven, Jensen had a keynote last night kind of explaining how much more longer this party has to go on for. It means that the infrastructure for the greatest revolution of all time in the history of humans, which was the internet because it connected the entire world, and now AI is accelerating the entire world, is going to be AI, which is also explaining Palantir's multiple. It explains Tesla's multiple. It explains why NVIDIA is able to put up 70% growth still from a freaking $80 billion base. Like, it doesn't make sense, the types of numbers that we're seeing right now. I mean, even ChatGPT, for all the problems people have with Sam Altman, they are nearing a billion users. They came out 2 years ago. No product goes from zero to a billion in 2 years. Even Cursor AI, they just raised a $10 billion valuation. They were the fastest startup, even faster than ChatGPT, to get to 100 million users or 100 million ARR. Now they're, I think they're at 300 million ARR, and they're an AI coding assistant. All they do is help you better code via AI. Like, it kind of blows my brain how sophisticated the LLMs can become, the types of use cases, whether it's robots, self-driving, et cetera. I'm going to Boston on Friday. I'm going to have a full 5-hour FSD road trip, see how the car does. But it's becoming one of those things where it's like, if productivity across every sector, either my personal productivity, because I can work in the car during FSD, or a company's productivity in terms of their margins go up, which means their share price has to go up as a result of their net income margin going up, and their price to earnings ratio is probably going up because they have more earnings per share, then we are in for the greatest bull market of all time. And I don't know when it ends, and when it ends, it might be a bubble that bursts in a crazy way, but I think we've got another 5 to 10 years on this bull market right now.
What are the variables that you're thinking about? And this question could be too early now, because again, from my perspective, it feels extremely early, because we don't have humanoid robots that do useful things yet. We don't have maybe O3 in some situations can do extremely tough tasks for you with a 5-minute prompt and just have the result for you, but it's a very narrow domain, yep. Right? Agents aren't really ramped up that much. Fully self-driving vehicles where you don't even have to worry about going from point A to point B very cheaply doesn't exist. We still have a giant energy bottleneck to actually power these systems. We have a chip bottleneck for compute, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Like, I hate to say this, I don't see, this is like the famous last words, I don't see anything in the way to double, triple, quadruple, quintuple in this market outside of some sort of war where literally we don't have access to chips, we don't have access to energy, which keeps us from doing it. And it could become an existential thing, like this black swan event where China does invade Taiwan. Like, y'all getting too much power, sorry, fuck you. No access to TSMC. But if you think about how Trump is, again, this is what a weird fucking time. How much is Trump trying to, and you talked about this too on your streams, right? How much of Trump doing what he's doing right with the administration is trying to create impossible to overcome economic dependencies between countries so that those wars don't happen, right? Because we are going towards this place where AI will make everything so much better. Anyway, I'm going to stop there because I don't even know what I just said. So I don't know if y'all can make any sense of what I just said.
your argument is, outside of a black swan event, what stops this train? And I don't think anything stops this train. Quite frankly, the China-Taiwan stuff, NVIDIA has a new headquarters in Taiwan. They announced yesterday, called Constellation. And I think my conspiracy here is that Jensen and Trump said, hey, I'll let you sell chips to the Saudis, but you've got to get a Taiwan headquarters to kind of be a little bit of a hedge against. Because if China invades Taiwan, they're invading NVIDIA as well.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Like, maybe there's some 4D chess going on there. But yeah, I don't see this stopping, because these agents are still kind of stupid. They can't book my flight. They can't change my schedule on the meeting. Like, they're getting smarter, but they're still pretty stupid, which means when they get really smart, what is that going to look like? The robots, as excited as we are, they still can't really do anything yet, right? We haven't seen them really implement any meaningful tasks for human beings. That's probably about 5 years down the line. The car is incredible. I don't intervene with my Tesla. It's just I can never cancel that $99 subscription. That's there for life, because
you need to just buck up, buy the subscription or the full thing outright right now, at least if you're planning to keep that car for any long period of time, because that subscription is not going to be $99 a month for much longer. And if you want the premium tier of functionality, you're going to be paying a lot more in subscription fees over the life of that vehicle than you would in just paying the $8,000 today.
So I agree. The one pushback I have against that is that they still don't have pricing power on FSD, because most people still don't use it, right?
Well, which, that's why
I'm not that concerned of the car,
because I got that FSD package for like a $2,500 or $3,000 premium on the used car versus buying the new.
Yeah. Well, regardless, I'm going to have to pay for it eventually. And if I have to keep paying $99, whatever, if I have to pay $8,000, but like, I need it. I need the damn thing because it's so good. And when you make a product that's just so good, like a Palantir, like a Hood, like, you just keep using it, right? So I don't think anything stops the train. I think there's new products every single day. Like, I'm working on something on Palantir's AIP. I might be launching it later in the year. I'm working with a friend. We're building something. That's all because of AIP. Like, there's so many different businesses and startups and new ways of thinking of the world that didn't exist. Just like before the internet, they didn't exist. Now with AI, it's going to hyper accelerate. I am concerned what it means about jobs, because maybe businesses don't need that many jobs if they have AI doing everything. But it does mean, as shareholders of these companies, we should be able to benefit from the greatest increase in market capitalization over the next decade. And, you know, anyone who's not in the investor class needs to find a way to become an investor. And it's as easy as downloading Robinhood and buying some NVIDIA or buying some Tesla, because the future's coming.
Or at least the NASDAQ, something.
Or the NASDAQ.
Yeah. So outside of, like, your, to restate what Amit said on your argument, it's outside of a black swan event, how does this thing stop? I would say it doesn't stop outside of a black swan event, but then let's hone in on those black swan events. Like, we're doing so much changing so fast that I think black swan events are more likely now than they've been before. And like across a while, like we can think of the couple that we can anticipate, like China invading Taiwan. But I think there's a whole number of other black swan type events that we don't have nearly as much visibility or ability to anticipate, because we're changing so many things so quickly on such a grand scale. Like, I think that we could break civilization in a number of ways. And there's only, you know, like 2, 3, 4, 5% of the ways that we could break it that we're thinking about. Let's try not to break it in those ways. And so I think that those, like, that's what the real risk is. But that said, I still want to be invested either way. Because, like, if those black swan events, like, I don't know how to prepare for those black swan events other than I would like to participate in the rally between now and then as much as possible, so I have as many resources at my disposal to navigate the black swan events as they arise.
I mean, I will tell you the one that I'm most afraid of, the black swan event, is the hyper aggregation of wealth and capability to a few. So, businesses with all the compute, people with all of the self-driving cars, organizations and people with all the robots, right? And then all of a sudden, these people become gods. I hate using that word, but they become significantly more capable than everybody else. And so how will they also gain in those gains? Like, what? So you need $200 O3 subscription. Maybe it's going to be $2,000 because of how powerful it is. How many people can afford $2,000 a month if they've just been laid off by like a Microsoft or whatever? Because they're like, well, we don't need you anymore. We got the agents now. What about, okay, well, I'm going to go do something physical. Ah, the bot can do that now. We're good. That, to me, like, that's the bubble. The bubble is the displacement of human labor. And at some point, it's going to reach a critical mass. Like, short of these people being able to take part of that growth. But, like, I don't understand the logistical path yet for these people to be part of that growth. They're going to get displaced. They're going to look for work. The work doesn't exist. Let's say they don't have the skills to start their own business. They don't have the pain tolerance to start their own business. They don't have the know-how or the environment and home to start the business. And then that pie grows and grows and grows and grows to where it reaches a critical mass. And then you literally have pitchforks on the streets and you have revolt, right? That, to me, that's my biggest black swan event. Like, that's how fundamental this is. Now, the counterbalance to that is like, well, we went through revolutions before, and what ends up happening is you increase the pie for everybody. So the assembly line and the automated factories didn't just put people out of work. They're now 1,000 times more factories that people can work at, right? It's just a different thing. So I don't know. This could be my AI doomerism side coming out of the whole AI robot event. But that, to me, that feels like, especially at Hans's point of how quickly things are changing, if we don't have the other side to be able to absorb that quick change, you're gonna have riots on the street.
I have a friend named Steve who couldn't agree with you more. Like, he thinks Microsoft just laid off 3% of their people. Rumors are that 3% is not just middle management. It's because of AI actually replacing some junior level engineers. I mean, you know, Learn to Code was the headline 2 years ago, right? Learn to Code. Now it's like, dude, I'm talking to some engineers who are leaving their big tech jobs. They're raising money. They're starting these, like, basically startups that anyone can code, essentially, if you just type in a prompt or whatever. And they're like, dude, coding is done. Like, this complex, and I mean, it's not literally
it's so
done,
over.
Their argument is like, what's the point of it? It's like prompting, like, it's like, why do we need calculators? Or why do we need the dictionary? Like, we know, like, everything's there, right? You don't need to. So from that perspective, why do we need an encyclopedia when you have ChatGPT? Like, and how many trees have we burned down to build encyclopedias for no, like, if the world is changing, yeah, I think there's an existential problem on what jobs will be created in the world of AI, if any meaningful level of jobs will be created, which I'm sure there will, but will it outpace the level of Uber drivers that are replaced? I don't think so. And so society is going to have to figure out how to deal with that.
Yeah, dude, like the coders and the drivers and the warehouse workers and the factory workers are all going to get displaced at the same time within a 3 to 5 year time frame. That's just the ramp up of the displacement of those workers is going to happen at the same time.
I would disagree about the timeline. I think the software stuff is going to happen ahead. Like our ability to scale the number of robots necessary to displace, like there's so many GDP expanding jobs for robots to do that don't even touch human labor for a, you know, for a long time still. Like until we're talking about tens of millions of robots produced each year, which I don't think is inside of the 5 year time horizon, then you're still just talking about doing jobs that nobody wants to do. So I think now, like on a grand scale, yes, I think that's the right way to think about it. But I think I think we do have more than 5 years. I think it's a 20-year transition more than a 5-year transition.
That's fair. Okay, so that enables the chance for absorption, right? So then the question becomes...
A little bit.
What are we doing to absorb it? Like, and I think that's going to be the
dude, the we're going to have to tax the shit out of these robot companies.
We have to, right?
I don't want to because I'm going to be a shareholder in them. But like, yeah. How else do I don't do it? If a million people lose their jobs as taxi drivers, as Uber drivers, as your point, for us, capitalism is based on the idea that people believe they have a chance. As soon as it becomes so unequal that people don't think they have a chance, Let's get ready to kill Elon Musk, kill Jeff Bezos, like all these big guys, and they know they're not going to survive if everyone's starving and all the money's going to shareholders. So I think there's going to be some type of robot tax, something.
Elon will just hire all the people who don't have jobs to be like, hey, go populate Mars. We'll pay your way.
Dude, you know, Elon's been sharing these tweets recently about, so when, I think I was 10 years old when I found out that Earth's going to die in like 4 billion years or something like that. You guys know that theory, right? The sun and all this.
Yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
So Elon's been tweeting a lot more about that recently. And I think he's trying to get people to realize, guys, like scientifically, this Earth will be gone one day. We need to move on. I don't know if we have the willpower to actually be able to get to another planet, but it seems like it matters.
Well, even if it's, you know, not going to Mars, like I think there is going to be the exciting orthogonal thing to all of this is that we're going to be putting all kinds of stuff up in space here in the not very distant future. Yeah. And so whether it's, you know, doing more stuff on orbit here around the Earth or going to the moon or, you know, any of these other places that are closer, like there's going to be a lot more industry and a lot of all that stuff takes money and it's going to need a combination of people and robots. And so like there are so many, I think new sectors of the economy that are going to just appear out of seemingly nowhere over the next 20 years is also going to be huge. And it's like, as long as you're growing into areas where they need at least, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5% of the labor done by humans, we have the ability to expand the overall TAM of what the economy is. Like Thomas Sowell's quote is, or his point is that economics is always just the practical application of how do we deploy scarce resources. And so if human time or energy, or more importantly, I think this is going to be the bigger factor, is desires. Like what do humans actually want to do?
Purpose.
Like that will be a big influencing factor on deciding what work do the robots and the AIs do. And, you know, I think that there are people, like, you don't have to know a whole lot about how to get AI and robots to do what you want it to do to be part of the, you know, human network that decides what the AI and the robots should do. And that, like, you know, everyone kind of de facto, just through the mechanism of the market, becomes a manager of AI and robotic labor and problem solving. And I think you should be able to get to participate in the, you know, upside of your contribution to deciding what work should be done.
The saddest and most, like, I think sad's the wrong word, but I think the painful reality of the situation is that if you really think about the percentage of people that are working just so they can get paid, just so they can live and survive, that is the Venn diagram overlap with what AI will displace. And so these are people that probably don't have a lot of savings. They probably don't have a lot of wealth. They don't have a lot of stock. They're just working so that they can go, you know, they work the 9 to 5, they go home and they just kind of do their thing, right? But they don't really have much besides that, okay? Those are the jobs that are going to get displaced. It's those like easy to replicate jobs, because when you have somebody in that job that's doing the work just so they can just go home and be able to like hang out, those jobs, probably they're not going to be that difficult to replace, okay? And that's the number, that is the largest number of people. And so if those people get displaced, what's going to happen? And I'm not talking about intelligence, I'm not talking about anything else, but literally that's just the overlap. And so what is the likelihood that that group of people, okay, are going to be able to transition into this new world smoothly? And that's where I get really fucking uncomfortable, because I don't feel like this society is equipped to be able to absorb that at all.
I personally think there's a relatively straightforward mechanism to help solve for that. You know, if we put regulatory stuff aside, like I think that people should be like Tesla, if we get to the point where Tesla's really making gajillions of Tesla Optimus robots and they're just doing all this work, and Tesla also rolls their own AI that makes the robots do all the stuff that, you know, creates this valuable labor, we should just distribute non-voting shares to literally every human on Earth. Just like everybody gets a share and you all get to participate in the upside of owning this thing that... Wow. Now, I don't want UBI. Everyone to... Not, I mean, it doesn't have to be UBI. Like, it's legitimate owner. It's not, you know, I don't want to give people cash. I want to give people a stake. And then, you know, there's going to be a bunch of people who do then sell those stakes to someone who wants to give them cash in exchange for it, because that's how the market will work. But, you know, it's a lot harder to be mad at someone who's like, hey, if we start to win a whole bunch, then, you know, your net worth expands.
Could that be part of the sovereign wealth fund, where maybe the sovereign wealth fund can start investing non-voting shares in these AI companies, and then that can be rolled into Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how you make sure that, and then people can just access that account and be like, oh my God, look, I have $700,000 worth of AI shares in like Tesla, Palantir, et cetera, et cetera. Because, you know, that's what you have to do if you want to operate in the United States. You have to give or whatever, or maybe I have a hard time that Tesla, out of the kindness of their heart, will just give away shares to people. But again, Elon has done altruistic things before many times.
It doesn't have to be altruistic. It just has to be realistically pragmatic.
Keep people like, from revolting.
I don't want to create a, you know, like I don't want to be so
And this is something we've seen. Everybody wins.
Everybody wins. And, you know, Elon has talked about this specifically. If civilization dies, Tesla dies. Like, we have to do the things that keep civilization alive. We have to do the things that make civilization thrive. We have to do the things that make civilization work, and our ability to preserve it persist. And that's why, like, you know, whatever you think about Elon Musk and his politics, that's his stated reason for participating in the political process the past few years. And so if he's thinking in terms of civilization and Western society and then global community and making sure that, you know, we don't extinguish ourselves as a species, then of course, like if there's even a 10% chance that running hog wild with Tesla Optimus extinguishes the human project, Elon will 100% think, yeah, maybe it's a better idea to just distribute, you know, non-voting ownership shares to all of humanity. And like, I guarantee, so whether or not that happens with Tesla, I guarantee you something like that happens with the people that go to Mars to create this civilization and settlement. Sure. Like, those people will be like de facto you know, recipients of an ownership stake in the organizations that are doing the Mars settlement.
So that requires literal, realistic pragmatism instead of greed.
Absolutely.
That requires overriding one of the biggest human flaws in history, which is like, oh no, I need this. Thank you. I need it. Right? It requires overriding that and saying, no, I don't care about the money necessarily. I care about building a better future. And for us to have a better future, we need to make sure people can also win in this future, because if they don't, then it all goes to hell, because every Tesla employee is going to have a target on their back because they're the ones taking everything. Right?
And this is the exact reason why I trust Elon Musk to do that more than any other human being on planet Earth, period. Even the Pope. Because
he's American.
Well, his heritage aside, he has never, like, Elon's willingness to put all the money that he has on the line to accomplish the grand mission that he has for humanity is like, you can tell that the money is not the thing that matters to him. You don't put all your money and then some into SpaceX, which has like 110% chance of failure, and Tesla, which only has like a 90% chance of failure, after you make millions of dollars on, you know, the sale of first Zip2 and then PayPal. If I want more is the fundamental substrate of your human operating system.
Yeah. So, but we need that mentality across every business leader in the future, especially if they are truly displacing
I just think you need enough of the big ones.
That's fair.
Yeah. I also think you there has to be some new paradigm by which we assess what value creation in society looks like. And right now it's mainly through an economic lens. But, you know, if people are staying at home, taking care of the kids, is that valuable? Do we actually pay for that? Like some of the European countries do. Is a hedge fund manager supposed to be making more than a teacher? I don't know. But if a hedge fund manager's job is replaced via AI, because maybe AI can manage a portfolio better than a hedge fund manager, but AI can't replace a teacher, does the teacher become more valuable? Like, these are really philosophical questions that we have to figure out. But technology is not stopping. And this train's going forward. The best way, I think, to participate is to be part of that train. And hopefully we can figure out all the smaller stuff into the future.
I agree. Especially if you have the means to participate.
Yeah.
Well, even if you don't have, you know, much in the way of means, like, okay, stop, you know, drinking that extra Starbucks this week and, you know, put that into owning something. Even, like I said, even if it's just the NASDAQ, you know, I don't think our audience specifically is made up of the type of people who want to invest in the NASDAQ over Jensen Huang. But, you know, whatever it is, ownership gives you, like, if you want to have influence over what it looks like, being a co-owner is the thing that gives you that voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wild. You have to have equity. You have to have equity, right?
So. Wild freaking times, man. Shit. And it feels like it's going to get crazier. Like, again, we're just at the beginning.
Real quick, Tessie 350 after those earnings. I mean, you guys must have been fuck all the bears, bro.
I mean, dude, hey, we've talked about this a lot on the channel. I really think that this goes to your point. The market is valuing AI.
Yeah.
Because if they're valuing Tesla's car sales, you got brand damage concerns. You have a dog shit Q1. You have a soft auto market. Okay. And Tesla is over a $1 trillion valuation. How are you not valuing artificial intelligence? You have to be valuing artificial. So the question becomes, what are the levers that Tesla is going to pull that will automatically, like, that will give the valuation the go ahead to say, yeah, okay, now you can go to 1.5. Now you can go to 2. Now you can go to 3. Like, okay, robotaxis, the speed of expansion, right? How quickly can you go into other states? Oh my God, Optimus is doing useful tasks in the company. Oh, Q1 2026, this is the first quarter where we realized some COGS savings because of our human to robot process. We were able to, you know, shave off $50 million in COGS. If that makes the stock go up 30%. Okay, just more robots.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia wants 1 million robotaxis. I mean, like,
right?
It's a hell of a point. Also, I don't think it's just retail, dude. I don't think retail could have pumped it from 220 to 330.
No, I agree.
At all.
And that's my point. I think the big guns the big guy, everybody's now on the same, it seems like we're all on the same page now. It's just a matter of, it's like, okay, how much are you willing to value? Before, it was a fundamental difference. It's like car company versus AI company, tech company. Then it was like, okay, tech company versus AI company, and maybe a car company. Now it's like, okay, AI company, but where are we going? Like, what are we talking about? Million robo taxis next year, a million robo taxis in 2030, and that's driving the valuation. So,
And how much are you willing to prepay? Like, how excited are you about those AI prospects, and how much are you willing to pay today for them? Like, that really is where we're at.
And from that perspective, that feels non-investment advice. It feels hella cheap because Tesla is the only company that can do millions of robo taxis per year and millions of humanoid robots, if not tens of millions of humanoid robots per year, because that robot we saw dancing learned with AI, right? And it's built to be scalable, right? It's built to be manufactured in the millions of units per year. Anyway, Amit, I know you got to go. So tell people where they can find you.
Twitter, YouTube. Amit is investing on Twitter, YouTube. I'm sure Farzad will put the link in the description, but really appreciate both your guys' support. You guys are crushing it. I'm so happy Tesla's doing great for you guys because it deserves to. It's a premier company right now. And Hans, are you gonna meet up with Farzad and test up the taxi in June?
Oh, that is definitely the tentative plan. We don't know when to plan it yet, but yes. Yeah,
we don't have a date.
That is a video I'm so looking forward to. So,
are you coming down?
So my parents are coming, my grandparents are coming from India, So in June, like the end of May till July. So it's gonna be a little tough to travel. If I can, I'll let you know. But I really want to see you guys both in a robot. Like, it's going to be so epic.
Don't worry. We got all kinds of fucking crazy shit planned. It's going to be awesome. Go check out Amit. He's the GOAT. Best finance YouTube channel on the internet. Truly just brings... I watch you to know what the fuck's going on. And I do that every day. And I'm shit posting on your chat because it's the best place to be. Okay? So thank you very much for coming. Really appreciate you. We'll do it again next month.
All right. Thank you, guys. Talk later.
Hey, nerds. Don't go anywhere just yet. As you may have noticed, when we launched into the beginning of the podcast, we were right in the middle of a conversation that referenced quite a lot of Robinhood, a lot of Vlad Tenev, but also involved some Elon Musk and a few other tech companies and visionary CEOs. And just the way the conversation flowed, we felt like it would be easier to actually cut that out of the beginning and place it right here at the end. But if you're interested in that part, that is coming up right now. Why do you love Vlad so much? Because, like, this is one of those things, you know, you always come on the show and you pick our brains and you screw you away without actually sharing all of that Amit wisdom. And so I'm flipping the tables on you today. And instead of talking about Elon and Tesla, I want to ask you, why is Vlad Tenev one of the best CEOs in all of public markets?
Well, it's a good question. I think so. I started investing in Robinhood when the stock was $8 back in 2023, and there was no one talking about it. There was no community around Robinhood, so I started posting about it because I got interested in the stock. It was $8 billion market cap. They had $6 billion in cash. I felt the stock was undervalued, but also I was using the product for like the past 6 years. So I was like, you know, kind of Peter Lynch says, buy what you invest in what you use every day. And it was kind of an easy Peter Lynch type of investment of like, okay, maybe Robinhood could be a company that could be a financial institution that just spawns across all these different ideas, dimensions, verticals, et cetera. I did not know the stock was going to go from 8 to 60. I definitely got lucky on that. But I also didn't know Vlad's execution in 2024 was going to be at a level that was unheard of. And obviously everything that happened in GameStop in 2021 took away the buy button, sell button, all that stuff, like that created a lot of stigma and resentment against him. And I think he spent 3 years with a stock in the low single digits dealing with the pain of the fact that the world hated him. And in 2024, he was ready to just change everything. That's what they did. And it was pretty remarkable. He was my first big interview when it comes to interviewing CEOs in February of 2024. Stock went from 8 to 20. From December 23 to February 2024. And I think a lot of the momentum and the excitement had changed around it. He's also someone who's very loyal. So like he wants to reward people that were there from the beginning. Same thing with Alex Karp. And so I was one of the only people really talking about it. And that's why they reached out to even do the interview. And then from 20 to 60, it's just been vertical after vertical after vertical that we can talk about that they've expanded in. And to me, it's just a guy who wants to take over the world. And for 3 years, he had to deal with the fact that he messed up really badly. And now he's in growth mode, and the growth is pretty aggressive.
So go back for a second before we talk about, you know, the mess ups and how he's fixing the mess ups to the product. You said you were using the product, and how was it better, different than anything else? What else did you try, and how was Robinhood different than other things that you had used?
So I discovered it in 2018. It was the first app I tried. I don't know how I got to it. I probably searched stocks on Apple, and then it popped up. And I downloaded it. And the reason I never used anything else, and I've tried other products like a Schwab, Fidelity, et cetera, it's just the after a couple of years of using Hood, and I remember the first experience, the first stock I bought was ironically NIO. So at $3, I thought NIO was going to beat Tesla in the EV race. And I sold it at $6, and NIO went to $60 in 2021. So I could have had a 20X. But it was just so easy to just swipe up and have a stock and buy it. And I think the experience of not having to pay for stocks and commissions, right, which is how most brokers made their money, and then the sort of argument around why people use Spotify over YouTube Music. It's like the UI, like it's a music app, but the UI and the data, the algorithms, the way they recommend music to you, it's just such a unique user experience, because that's a tech company that really they employ people who give a shit about the user experience. That's the same thing with Robinhood. And I felt that 26 other million people feel that. And that's why it's hard for me to leave.
I feel the opposite of that. I have an Interactive Brokers account right now, and I hate their user interface. It's awful. The reason to stay with them is because they have, you know, good interest rates on, you know, if you want to take loans out against your product. And man, like, you could do anything in Interactive Brokers, but good luck figuring out how, and good luck getting your money in, and good luck getting your money out. It is a pain.
I agree. My uncle has an Interactive Brokers account in India. I was with him in October, and I was trying to use it. I was like, what are we doing? But their margin is way better than Robinhood. They're just more established brokers, so they have so many better features right there. But the user experience on Robinhood is insane. I mean, I just tweeted a picture just now. My mom's getting into option selling. I can share this right here. And she just sent me a picture of collecting $1,400 in credit from selling some covered calls against Robinhood and NVIDIA. And she's been W-2 her whole life. She doesn't know what it means to make $1,400 in 10 days based on just like pressing a couple buttons. But the fact that she's able to figure it out, she would not be able to do this on Schwab, Fidelity. Like, it would just, and like, people underestimate that. The biggest debate I was having when Robinhood They wouldn't even let her, right? They'd be like, what are you trying to do here, right? Like, you have to have your account at a certain size or whatever. The biggest debate I was having when Robinhood was $6 was, is there a moat? And I think it's a deep question, right? Because with Tesla, I think there's such a deeply ingrained moat. Everyone understands it. And now we're just waiting for the growth to really kick off to establish and prove how big of a moat they have. But Robinhood, I'm sympathetic to the argument that it's not a moat. It's just a brokerage. Anyone can copy their UI and redesign the app. And in 2023, I think the contrarian bet I made was that no one was going to copy them because no one actually had the focus on the technology culture that they had. For example, I was at their gold event back in March. I was speaking to one of the product managers, and he was showing me a new feature. And he was showing me the vibration, the haptics on moving the circle on a stock in this new like UI they came up with. And he was like, isn't that really cool? Like the vibration you feel? And I'm like, oh shit, these guys care about the vibration on my fingertips when they're talking about user experience. That's why they have a moat, because no other fintech company is caring about that type of user experience. And so from that perspective, it's just hard to replicate them, which is why I think they're surviving today.
So for me, who's a layman about Robinhood, who like I barely use it, if ever, because I don't really trade much, and the handful of times that I do want to take a position, I just go into my usual E-Trade thing and I just do it. You know, as of late in the last like 6 months, I started getting back into like calls and stuff. But like I'll just, but like it's a handful of movements a year. And so for me, like my exposure to Robinhood is not nearly as much as it could be because I just don't really buy and sell that much that often.
You buy and hold. You're that type of
guy. I buy and hold. So, okay. So is Robinhood dependent on a group of people that trade for them to actually have a moat long term? Because it's the frequency at which you interface with that UI that separates them, right? But isn't that more akin to gambling than it is to investing? And is that really something that's feasible long term for them to herald as like, hey, this is why people want us over everybody else? Like, how do you think about that argument?
Yeah, it's a great question. Definitely. So the first part to your question is you need people engaged on the platform doing trades, whether it's options, crypto, stocks, whatever it may be, in order for there to be revenue potential, right? That's their transaction revenues. The sort of counter against your argument is that once you get people on the platform, there's another part of the business called interest revenues, which is credit card and stock lending and just cash sweep, right? If they're able to collect your cash, they can get a spread on the interest rates given the Fed funds rates at 4.5%. All of that comes from user engagement. So if I sell, you know, a couple contracts a week on Robinhood, I buy a couple of dollars worth of Bitcoin, I DCA into my favorite Tesla, Robinhood Pouncher, or whatever, then I'm more likely to apply for the credit card, which is 3% cash back across the board. It's rivaling Amex and Chase Sapphire, right? I'm more likely to lend out my stocks and have them make a spread on the percentage of my stocks they can lend to short sellers. I'm so much more likely to be upsold into all these different products. Robinhood Banking, that's coming out in September. So they're really upping the ante in terms of all these different integrated ecosystem features they can provide. And that's what I think also gives them a long-term moat. In terms of the gambling thing, I would counter the gambling narrative with sophisticated retail investors. So if you're buying zero DTE options that expire the next day, you're gambling, right? And you have the right to do that. But yeah, you're gambling and maybe Robinhood makes it really easy for you to gamble. But I think a lot of retail investors are starting to realize they can use the derivatives market in financial systems and play the volatility to the upside or to the downside. So when things were going down in April, people were able to, I mean, I had a friend who took $7,000 and turned it into $200,000 within 3 days by playing the volatility on the downside.
Good for him.
Yeah. And I have other friends that are doing it to the upside. But so I think the tone of retail has always been dumb money, but we've seen in the data, you know, dumb money bought the dip in April. And we were pretty smart enough to know Trump was not going to have 150% tariffs forever, whereas hedge funds got so upset, they sold everything, and now they're having to chase this rally. But Robinhood gave a lot of people the tools and the infrastructure, the ecosystem, the UI, UX, to feel sophisticated enough. So is there a part of gambling to it? Yes. Do they need to be engaged every day for them to make money? Yes. But I think the more and more retail investors learn about the markets, the more they actually make really good decisions, which keeps them engaged, but also makes Robinhood a lot of revenue as well.
So that's such a great counter, and this is where I think there is potential for something like a Robinhood, and it comes down to just financial education. Like you just sort of mentioned this, right? I remember very vividly when I was at Tesla, when I was working there, and it was I think it was 2020-ish timeframe, or 2019, 2020-ish timeframe. One of the things that Tesla did really well was, you know, if you're a full-time employee, you get stock, right? And Tesla stock is one of the most, let's say, popular things to talk about. And yep. So by default, everybody was like, oh, I'm getting this. There's this ESPP program, this employee stock purchase program, right? Which is very common for public companies. They're like, I don't even know what that means. What does that mean? I could take a percentage of my money and put it in that. What does that mean? Okay, cool. Oh, look, I can choose to take my a part of my bonus in either stock or calls or like options. What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah. like you know, when I first came on board, they're giving me this much stock. Like, what's the potential? How high can that go? Right? There were all these different questions, and then what I came to realize is like 80% of the people, 90% of the people that held Tesla stock because they worked there didn't even understand what the price was. Like, they didn't understand that the price of the stock was a function of the market capitalization divided by the number of shares outstanding. They did not understand that. And they will look at that price, and they will look at Apple and be like, wow, Apple's $100 and Tesla's $300. It's so expensive. I'm like, no, God, no, please.
And so my dad does that every day, by the way. He's like, oh, NVIDIA is more expensive than Palantir. I'm like, no, Dad. Just because they're both 130 doesn't mean NVIDIA.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was at that moment, I'm like, wow, man. Like financial literacy, like the. I mean, I set the education question aside because I don't want to turn this
stock market literacy, which is somewhat different than general financial literacy.
100%. But it's one of those things. It's like if you want to build wealth, you have to invest your money into assets, and like stocks is one of the best assets you can get into in this day and age, in my opinion. But anyway, so there's huge. What's that?
Tech stocks.
Fair enough.
The right tech stocks.
Yes. Fair enough. So what that tells me is that the number of people that could buy stocks that don't know anything about stocks, and if they're well informed in buying stocks, right, that is the market for Robinhood that seems perfect. And I feel like it's at a fraction of what it could be, right? So when we're thinking about like long-term growth for the company, the more people that understand how the stock market actually goes, then Robinhood, in theory, with their UI, becomes a de facto place for these people to go. because like you said, interactive brokers, I never play with them, but I always hear that they're complicated, but the super users love it because it gives you so many options. But then E-Trade, like, you know, like if like my father-in-law, for example, is like, he needs help going through his stock account because he doesn't know what anything means. He doesn't know where to go, right? Like a lot of these investment firms or these like brokers are not at all sophisticated when it comes to interfacing with their retail customers, right? But again, but the flip side of that is just software. Well, just make your UI better. But we know from the conversation we just had, UI is a whole thing. Like there's a reason why people went to Facebook instead of MySpace. There's a reason why people, like you said, use Spotify instead of Apple Music and blah, blah, blah. You know, you have network effects, et cetera, et cetera. So does this align with the core thesis of how the company is trying to like, is that how they talk to their investors? Or like, hey, as stock market literacy goes up, we're going to get more customers and we're at the very early stages of this.
Well, and beyond just how do they talk to their customers, I'd be also, if not more interested in how do they talk to their employees about this?
Yeah, so their tagline for the past 10 years has been democratizing finance, which I know it's a very Silicon Valley type of thing to say democratizing finance, but like the whole point is they want to bring financial literacy, stock market literacy, to the entire world. And the more people that have that democratized, the more people that have an understanding of basic financial markets, the more people that understand you can own a share of Apple or Tesla and not just buy the iPhone or the car, the greater Americans are going to be. I mean, 50% of the country is not invested in stocks. Now, a lot of the country is invested because of 401ks, but most people have no idea what their 401k is or what it's invested in or what the point of some of that money leaving their check every week is going into. So from that perspective, yeah, I think more people that learn about the markets, more people that care about the markets, more of a total addressable market Robinhood has for their users. In terms of how they talk about their employees, so they have an average revenue of about $1.1 million per employee. They only have about 2,400 people. So it's a very lean company. And I got the privilege to speak to a decent chunk of employees over the past couple of years. They hire the best of the best. They're very similar to Palantir. They hire really, like Vlad has been on record saying, I'd rather pay 5x more for an engineer than get like 10 people at a lower cost, because he just knows when you pay for the right talent, you're going to get the right infrastructure, you're going to get the right UI, you're going to get the right designers, you're going to get people that actually give a shit about the product. I mean, one of the reasons why people can't replicate Robinhood is because it's almost like, so there's a story about Instagram that when you went to load a picture back in 2012, and you're picking the filters because everyone was obsessed with the filters, before you press post, the database engineering that the Instagram guys worked on essentially uploaded your picture already. And all you had to do was click post. And then it was like just clicking yes as a permission, but it wasn't actually uploading the photo. So after you're doing your filters in the background, the photo is uploading, you press yes, boom, it's out there. And everyone gets this dopamine of like, oh my God, I just put this picture out into the world. On Robinhood, the back end of how quick it is to build, to get a stock to go into the right trade or into the right option contract, whatever, I think it's hard to re-architect that engineering. And that's because they have the best talent in the world. So yeah, I think the talent is really important. And they basically communicate to their investors that they're going to pay a lot for talent, but that talent should lead to better results.
So, you know, one of the reasons that I'm asking this question is because I've started to see a whole bunch of people that have really good taste in CEO selection be really excited about Robinhood. So that wouldn't just be you. That would also be people like Joe Bakhti. Man, I'm blanking out on a couple of, but I keep seeing, Chris Camillo has been really high on Robinhood recently. And yeah, just a number of other people who are extremely, deep into people like Alex Karp or Elon Musk, or, you know, even people who are able to invest in private companies like Anduril and Palmer Luckey. So one of the questions I have is, it seems like, you know, Elon talked about making X into what he always wanted, X.com originally, then PayPal to become this finance everything hub where, you know, the money comes in and then they have an option for you to do everything with your money inside of this ecosystem. But it seems like right now, Elon's got way too much on his plate to actually execute on that. That's just gone way too far down the priority stack to make that happen for X. And it seems like Robinhood and, you know, maybe SoFi kind of has that vision too. Like SoFi's trying to go from banking into stocks, and Robinhood's trying to go from stocks into banking. But it seems like maybe Robinhood has a leg up in just their maybe the quality of their execution combined with the quality of their user experience to actually achieve that. Like, is that what people are so excited about?
Yeah, I mean, look, Robinhood gets compared to a lot of companies. SoFi is one of them. X with payments, if they ever kind of roll out a fully integrated ecosystem of payments, I'm sure they'll be compared to them. I just think what's really important to understand the Robinhood thesis and why people are so excited about Vlad is the level of innovation, or the level of execution against the innovation. I mean, I could name literally 15 different things they've done in the past year, past 9 months, it hasn't even been a year, that are new products, new features, new geographies, new locations, new even small little minute things that people have been waiting for years for the app, like tax slots, being able to sell certain types of stock that you bought years ago, that have all been integrated, executed, implemented, and people love those features. And they've got...
He's not a Jack style executor?
He is not a Jack Dorsey that will not get an edit button on Twitter for 10 years. I mean, that's the one thing that makes me not invest in Square. I hope Square does very well, but first of all, I can't believe what Elon has done with Twitter that Jack wasn't able to do for a decade. Elon did in less than 10 months. Number two, the level of censorship that Jack must have been a part of, obviously, and saw what was happening. There's a classic pod with him and Joe Rogan and one of their lawyers trying to sugarcoat everything with Tim Pool. Like, it was all nonsense. And Elon came and just, it's not perfect. There's still censorship on Twitter because Elon has to deal with Turkey and stuff like that, but it's way better than before. So Vlad is not one of those types of people that is going to sit by. And from talking to the employees, he pushes them hard, bro. Like he works 24/7 and he puts that in the culture. And there are some employees that told me, like, yeah, there's a little bit of like intensity here. Like intensity to the point where, like, you're not going to have a job at Robinhood if you are not executing at the level that he's executing at. And he sets the tone. And so from that perspective, I've been buying the stock at $60. It's at basically all time. It was at 80 in 2021, but it's basically at all time highs right now, because I just believe this will be the Amazon of finance. This will be a much bigger company than it is a decade from now. And I'm very comfortable giving my money to Vlad. Whereas I know in 2021, people hated him, but I think things have changed and I think he's ready to execute.
What's very interesting about this conversation is that it reminds me of the variables that people look for in investing in companies. Hans mentioned, you know, that like I've been listening to people that have good taste in CEOs. And I'm really curious to get your opinion on this, Amit, because you follow the broader market. You are very knowledgeable about a lot of unique companies, tech companies, innovative companies. But to me, it feels like the common thread that retail investors seem to have figured out how to properly value is culture, is CEO, it's the staff. Whereas the broader, like the rest of the market, Wall Street is much more focused. They overweight earnings. They overweight cash flow. They overweight like recent earnings performance, right?
Lagging indicators.
They overweight. They put too much of a sort of value in like the traditional metrics, but there is no way for them they choose to ignore like who the CEO is. Why is he special? Who has he surrounded himself with? What kind of culture have they implemented, right? Or she? Like what does the staff say about the CEO? How flat is the org? What are they working on? Like, what's the actual technology? Do I understand the technology?